From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As President Trump pardons a slew of white-collar criminals, some Detroiters are asking for consideration for Kwame Kilpatrick.
That is an absolute nightmare that I do not want to even test out.
What would a commutation do for Trump's standing in Metro Detroit? Also on the show, a new documentary tells the story of how the green lakeside town of Oscoda became contaminated with PFAS.
It wasn't a story that should be told in any other form than a visual form because it was so complex, but also I wanted people to feel the same way I felt when I first visited. I wanted them to see what I saw.
And a year of return in Ghana, two Detroiters talked to us about connecting and rethinking their place in the world.
It was past the point of people just coming for a novelty. People were coming for a real connection because they were invited home.
All that's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to tell you about a new documentary film that brings the story of PFAS contamination on a U.S. military base in the small town of Oscoda near Lake Huron, and how the U.S. government has yet to regulate these harmful chemicals to this day in drinking water. But first, President Trump has pardoned and commuted sentences of several powerful white-collar criminals, including the former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich. One prisoner notably not on the list of those granted clemency yesterday was former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. He's currently serving a 28-year sentence for racketeering and fraud. But Kilpatrick still has powerful people in his corner, lobbying the president to put an end to Kilpatrick's lengthy stay in federal prison. Let's listen. Here's CompuWare founder Peter Karmanos speaking with journalist Charlie LaDuff on his No BS NewsHour podcast.
You think Trump is actually considering?
Yes.
Pardoning Kwame?
Yes.
Because you are a billionaire and you got a line into the White House. So you're saying this from personal knowledge that the president is considering it?
Sure.
We've talked about this before. Back in 2013, Michigan Radio asked the person then serving as federal prosecutor who tried Kilpatrick to talk about that possibility. Here is Barbara McQuaid, then federal prosecutor for the Eastern District, when the guilty verdict came down against Kilpatrick.
The former mayor was not focused on running the city. He was focused on using the mayor's office as a money-making machine for himself and his family and friends. He was grabbing money from the citizens.
These days, Barbara McQuaid is a professor at the University of Michigan. She will not comment on the case. She says federal cases should be discussed by prosecutors currently overseeing those offices. But we still had plenty to ask her about regarding clemency and how it's used by any sitting president. Barb McQuaid, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Glad to be with you.
It's common for anyone in the legal profession to get to the end of the case and there is a resolution with the realization that there may be appeals processes going forward. What are the circumstances in which commutation is considered and is sometimes considered appropriate?
There is an Office of Pardon Attorney at the Department of Justice, and that pardon attorney looks at applications that are submitted by people for either pardons or commutation of sentence, which means a shortening of sentence. Together, those two things are referred to as clemency. So when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, President Obama had a program under what he called Smart on Crime, where he frequently used that to address cases involving people who were sentenced to lengthy sentences in drug cases that would be charged differently today. So if someone got a sentence of, say, 40 years or life under a sentencing policy that would be different if they were charged today. Typically, they were seeking clemency in those cases. But the process is typically someone has expressed remorse, has admitted what they have done, has served a substantial portion of their sentence. And in those instances, the president may review those petitions and decide whether they think it's appropriate to either shorten the sentence through commutation or pardon the person altogether as a show of mercy for the remorse that that person has shown. And then the president has the power to do that under the Constitution.
So it's important to point out that this is something that has to be asked for, and not just asked for, but that there has to be a case made.
Well, typically that is the case. I don't know that it's a requirement, but there is a process through the Department of Justice because under the Constitution, it just gives the president the power to grant pardons.
This week, President Trump went on something of a clemency blitz, commuting the prison sentence of the former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, and pardoning a long list of well-known people, including the former commissioner of the NYPD, Bernard Kerik, who was sentenced on tax evasion and fraud charges, and the financier, Michael Milken. He did not comment on every single case, but we know at least in the case of Rod Blagojevich, because he tweeted it, he said he felt that the sentence was too long. How does that hang over prosecutors and judges thinking in the sentencing phase of a trial?
Well, I can just tell you my view on that, which is that don't forget that this sentence was fashioned by a judge who sat through the entire trial, heard arguments by lawyers for the prosecution and the defense, and fashioned what under the law is supposed to be a sentence that is sufficient but no greater than necessary to achieve the purposes of sentencing, which include deterrence and respect for the rule of law. And so when a president comes in after the fact and says, I think it's just too long, I think there's a sense that he's simply substituting his judgment for the one that was formed during the case. But of course, it's his prerogative to do that. As we said, during the Obama administration, President Obama thought some of the sentences were just too long in some of these drug cases. And so he has the prerogative to do that. I think that where I find maybe something objectionable to what the president is doing here, though, is some of his other comments where he said that all he did was make one phone call and he's already served 7 years in prison because of that, part of a 14-year sentence. It sounds awfully familiar to the defense that President Trump himself has run about only one phone call that was a perfect phone call in what was actually a larger corruption scheme. And the same is true with regard to Rod Blagojevich. There were 18 counts that he was convicted of corruption relating to his office, that he frequently used his office as a profit center. He would extort people into making campaign contributions, a children's hospital, some developers of real estate, as well as attempting to sell President Barack Obama's Senate seat when he became the president and that seat became vacant. So it was an entire course of conduct that I think is not accurately described as a single phone call.
Is there anything baked into the judicial process that helps to bolster the work that has been done is there anything preventing someone in executive office from somehow lessening the impact of all the work that has been done by just commuting a sentence?
Well, I think there's always still the deterrent effect of potential prosecution and prosecution. I don't think anybody would want to go through the process of being convicted in hopes that some future president will pardon them or grant clemency. But I do think it sends a harmful message because if you look at not only the Blagojevich pardon, but also some of the others here, Bernard Kerik, who was at one time Rudy Giuliani's driver, who ascended to this job, high-level job in the police commission, and Michael Milken, all of these charges involve some sort of fraud or corruption or obstruction of justice. And I think it sends a message that these are not serious crimes, that these are not, they're different from crimes like violent crimes. And we shouldn't take them so seriously and that these long sentences are excessive in these cases. And I would argue just the opposite, that these are cases that are based on greed. These are not people who found themselves without hope or alternative in society, but were wealthy and powerful and chose to exercise that power to just get even richer and even more powerful by gathering what they could when they could. And so I think those are the kinds of crimes that undermine public confidence in our government and for that reason are the most important to punish.
Well, it sometimes is difficult for people to separate what should happen with what does happen, especially in the sort of winner-take-all climate that seems to be today's politics. Is there a reason for people to think that political considerations are not at the end of the day what determines sentences like these?
So that's the kind of question that I think President Trump's conduct raises, and I think one that is so harmful to our respect for the rule of law. We are a system of laws and not of men. We should make sure that people are dealt with fairly and punished appropriately. And when people see that if you are wealthy or powerful or well-connected, you get an opportunity to do things that the rest of us don't, I think that causes erosion in our system of government and in public trust of the criminal justice system.
I know that you cannot talk about the case of Kwame Kilpatrick, but really we don't even have to go there. We could talk about sentencing discrepancies at any other level of the justice system. As people are looking at sentences, commutations, and other forms of clemency, and see white-collar defendants getting consideration at a higher rate than African-American defendants, what are they left to think?
You're absolutely right about that. And I think that there is a tendency in this country, in our courts, to punish white-collar defendants more leniently than other defendants on this theory that their crimes are somehow less serious or that because of good deeds they have done, they are less deserving of punishment. But I think that that is a really dangerous way to look at the rule of law. You would hear things like, my client has been punished enough by the shame that he has endured from his conviction, and so a sentence of a probation is more appropriate for him. Why, he can't even walk into his country club and look anyone in the eye after the publicity that this case has garnered for him. What does that say? It says that the privileged get these breaks that other people who don't have these well-connected reputations don't get. And I think that's just the 100% wrong way to look at these things. People should be judged on the basis of their conduct, of what they did wrong, and held accountable, because otherwise it erodes respect for the rule of law and trust in government.
If you cannot answer, we certainly understand, but did you ever imagine that Kwame Kilpatrick's name would be part of the political landscape and discussion in 2020?
I can't answer anything relating to him whatsoever, but all I can say is that I think that we need to look at crimes that are based on greed and using the abuse of power to obtain things that someone's not entitled to as very serious crimes. And I worry that President Trump is kind of grooming the public. He is trying to desensitize us and inure us to the idea that these are serious crimes so that he can use this power of pardon or perhaps even his own misconduct and be able to elicit from the public just a shrug when instead it should elicit outrage.
Barb McQuaid, thank you very much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, April.
As we said a little bit earlier in the show, there are powerful people advocating to get Kwame out of prison. I want you to listen to this. It's another part of CompuWare founder Peter Karmanos' conversation on Charlie LaDuff's podcast.
I do know that if Trump gave him clemency before the election, where do you think he would help Trump's campaign at?
When we come back, we're going to touch base with someone on the ground with the Democratic Party in Detroit about how clemency might play out with voters, especially black voters in Metro Detroit, for the presidential race this fall. Stay with us. That's coming up after the break. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's good reason Kwame Kilpatrick, a convicted criminal, still wields influence over powerful friends and many voters in Detroit. He was well known as a young, smart, charismatic, up-and-coming voice in the city and in the Democratic Party. Here's Kilpatrick when he was mayor, elected in 2001 at just 31 years old.
I love Detroit. I love Detroit. And I pledge to you today that I will spend every waking hour in the next 4 years working to help Detroit achieve all the things that this wonderful city can achieve.
So what kind of influence might Kwame have in the city and its voters if Donald Trump were to commute his sentence? With us to talk through the possibilities is Jonathan Kinlock, chair of the 13th Congressional District for the Democratic Party. He's also a member of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers. Jonathan, welcome to Stateside.
Good afternoon.
So, cards on the table, first of all, do you have an opinion one way or the other on whether President Trump should pardon Kwame Kilpatrick?
Personally, I don't have an opinion. But you know that's a sore spot on both sides of the issue as far as Kwame Kilpatrick continuing to serve 28 years. And, you know, there's also some deep thoughts as relates to whether or not President Trump should commute his sentence. But, you know, as chair of the 13th Congressional District, a couple of months ago, members of the Democratic Party in the 13th actually introduced the resolution calling on President Trump to pardon both Kwame Kilpatrick and Bobby Ferguson. So that resolution did pass, but I did not participate in that vote.
What was the first thing on your mind when you heard that President Trump had exercised clemency this week for a whole bunch of high-profile white-collar criminals?
Hell to the no. I'm like, so does this really mean that this is a real possibility that Kilpatrick would actually be pardoned? Look, so my perspective is that there was a lot of facts and issues that came out from that trial. As you know, that was a very sore spot for the city of Detroit. And my thought is that, you know, maybe 28 years was a little harsh, a lot harsh. But whether or not he should be released at this point for political purposes and political gain, I'm totally against that.
Is Kwame Kilpatrick's 28-year sentence something that you think is still top of mind for folks in the 13th? I mean, how does this rate compared with kitchen table concerns?
Like down, deep down, on low on the list as far as what people want public policymakers to be discussing. But this is an issue that is of political fodder, you know, of sort, since it's been raised in the media. So folks are talking about it, and there's a lot of folks with different opinions on both sides.
Now, can we just step back for a moment and review Donald Trump's success in the metro area back in 2016? I mean, my understanding is that he was not popular.
Why you want to do that?
I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, let's go back to 16. So I'm there with you. So how do you want to proceed?
So was anybody you know posting signs or even without being very public about it voting for Donald Trump?
Not in Detroit, and like you said, I'm on the county board of canvassers, and what we saw, 47% of the voters in Wayne County who actually voted for Donald Trump, that was shocking. And, you know, so I never would have thought that he would have won Michigan, and you see that the margin of victory was only by, I believe, 10 or 11,000 votes statewide. So it was definitely something, an election that result alone says that it should not have happened.
Well, let's put it in context. I mean, I also know that there was a fair amount of the 13th that didn't really turn out for the top of the Democratic ticket either.
That's absolutely correct. And that's why I'm saying that result should not have happened, because we should have had a higher turnout in the 13th Congressional District, which is the only congressional district that is entirely in within Wayne County. But, you know, you're absolutely correct. There was a lot of folks who did not vote, but there's a reason for that as well.
Right. Well, needless to say, the lack of turnout for Hillary Clinton in 2016 has served as a constant reminder to national Democratic Party leaders that they need to think very seriously about their engagement with voters, and especially with black voters in places like the 13th. Do you see that happening so far?
Not at this point, but we do understand where we are in a political process. You have these early caucus and primary states that warrant the attention of the candidates and their resources. But you do see some folks who have chosen to be actively engaged in the metro Detroit area, you know, here in Michigan. But at this point, the type and the size of attention that I would deem necessary and appropriate for someone taking Michigan serious, I haven't seen that yet. But like I said, we're still going through the primary and caucuses right now.
When people talk about Kwame Kilpatrick's conviction in the 13th and that 28-year sentence, would you say that that fits into their experience of how those in power have treated and maybe still treat Detroit?
Not just Detroit, but that's just for many, it's emblematic of how blacks are treated in the criminal justice system. But I have to say that what Kwame Kilpatrick did during his tenure was serious, and people definitely understand that. So no one's giving them a pass. But when you say 28 years and no one was killed, yes, we're still paying off some of those costs and other things as a city. But 28 years
like I said, it creates a lot of chatter and concern and doubt and faith in the system, you know, for sentencing him that long.
Right. Well, so then do you think that there is a danger if Donald Trump did give clemency that some black voters would just hold their noses and take a deep breath and give him some serious consideration this fall?
That is an absolute nightmare that I do not want to even test out. But you have to admit that Kwame Kilpatrick still has a lot of supporters in this city. That would be something that would not be something that I would be looking forward to, because I think it would potentially could have Donald Trump getting more Republican votes out of Detroit than any other Republican in the last billion years.
It sounds like you're taking the possibility seriously, at least.
Oh, no. Let me say this. Donald Trump is somebody that you definitely don't know what door he's going to come from. Let me just say, I'm not on that bandwagon calling for the sentence to be commuted anytime before November.
Jonathan Kinlock, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today.
Thank you for asking me on. I look forward to continuing conversations in the future.
Jonathan Kinlock is chair of the 13th Congressional District for the Democratic Party in Michigan. Water around the Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Oscoda, Michigan, was discovered to be contaminated by PFAS in 2010. And to this day, the problem has not been solved. In a new documentary entitled No Defense, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Sarah Ghanem explores why U.S. EPA has failed to regulate PFAS in drinking water, or even force the cleanup of sites like Oscoda. The film is loaded with moments showing what it's like to live in a place where toxicity has become such a part of everyday life.
For 3 years, we hauled water in here because we were afraid about the contamination. And people would say, well, you know, it's been here forever. But over the years, so many people have had cancer in my family. And I just accepted that was sort of our genetic fate.
No Defense screens in Ann Arbor tonight with its producer in attendance. Sarah Ghanem is, again, winner of a Pulitzer Prize for her journalism work breaking the Jerry Sandusky story. And Tony Spaniola will be there as well. He's an attorney and founding member of Need Our Water in Oscoda, a longtime activist on water issues. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, you had lived in Michigan, but had not been here for several years. What brought you back to Michigan and to Oscoda?
You're right. I was born really not that far from here in Livonia, Michigan. I first came back really for work during the Flint water crisis. I was with CNN and very quickly realized that it was not a story that could be covered in a couple of days, and ended up spending quite a bit of time here over several months. And during that time, that's really where the beginning of the story was for me, because the issue of water contamination across America, that was where I was enlightened to that issue. And that was where I met a lot of the people who eventually told me about this story in Oscoda. And it wasn't until several years later, I left CNN after I had a baby. I knew I wanted to continue to cover water contamination in America, not just in Michigan, but I also knew I wanted to return here and find out how Flint had changed the way the state looked at water contamination. And immediately, this story was right in front of me. And it was such a visual story. The moment that I first met Tony in Oscoda on Van Etten Lake, I mean, to me, it wasn't a story that should be told in any other form than a visual form, because it was so complex, but also very visual. And I wanted people to feel the same way I felt when I first visited. I wanted them to see what I saw.
Which are these beautiful lakes and forests and houses situated picturesquely all around the edge of the lakes, and people who've built their lives around a gorgeous natural setting, which turns out to be totally poisonous.
Absolutely. I mean, in any other, any other circumstance, I would want to bring my family there. I would want to share what looks like amazing times, right? And then, the more you learn about what's really going on, it's very heartbreaking to see it for the people who have to deal with it, and for people not just with, a picturesque lake house, but people who maybe don't live on the lake but are still dealing with the contamination and cannot afford to go anywhere else or to live any other way. Those people in the present right now,
they're stuck. They just have to take it. And that's part of the story that we tell.
Just a quick recap. When we say PFAS, we're talking about that class of chemicals that is widely used industrially in the United States and around the world, especially in military air bases and airports, but also in many, many, many different consumer products, everything from rainwear to nail polish, as the film notes. Tony, a lot of Michiganders have been awakened to the danger of PFAS. What aspects of the story did you feel still had not been told that could be unlocked with this film?
Well, I felt that it was really important for people around the state and the country to understand what people in their daily lives in Oscoda and places like Oscoda have to contend with. So many times we hear things, you know, with this alphabet soup of PFAS, and then there's 5,000 or 6,000 or however many of those chemicals, and they start talking in scientific terms. We lose the fact that it impacts people, and it impacts people in a very, very major way. So I think that it's that story that hasn't been told. And what also hasn't been told, I don't think, or realized, is that Oscoda really is ground zero nationally. It's the first military installation, actually in the world, U.S. military installation in the world at which this was discovered, and the first site in Michigan. And pretty much everything in Michigan that's happened on PFAS can trace its roots back to Oscoda. So I think that's another really important aspect of this.
That process of selecting the details in everyday life that are going to really tell the story. Sarah, you had a lot of choices. You talked to people who worked on the base with firefighting foam, people who washed their cars in it, people who took their kids to go play in the stuff. It's so shocking how normalized everything was, but how did you make your decisions among the many ways in which this was normalized in Oscoda life?
That was a big challenge, you know. We ended up with, I would say, 5 to 6 really, you know, strong characters who we wanted to tell their stories, and then a couple of experts on top of that, which was still, it was still a challenge to tell all of those stories in 72, 73 minutes. But really, for me, there's two things here. There's the historic contamination when the base and bases like it were active. The exposure the veterans who worked on these bases, you know, had from drinking the water, from using AFFF, and the civilians who worked there too. So there's that. And then there's the present day. In a lot of contamination stories, when they're historical like this, you can't go back. You cannot change the way that things were done. And that, you sort of view that through a certain prism. But when you're talking about that combined with the fact that as we sit here and have this conversation, this chemical is still leaching out of the from the base
as
and into the lake. Right. It's still happening. And there is nothing being done to stop it from happening. Very little being done to stop it from happening. So there are people who live there right now who are still exposed. And there is very little help for them. And so to me, that was really the two parts that we had to tell. We had to talk about the historic contamination and what that did to people, but also how those lessons have not yet been learned from.
This piles on to an article that Bridge Magazine published back in November that noted, it's 2010 to 2019 at the writing of the article, and there is still no plan for the cleanup. Tony, has Oscoda seen any changes since November?
No. I'm sorry to say that.
That's a devastatingly short answer.
Yeah. No, there has been. The Air Force has submitted a draft of the next phase of what they plan to do. It's lengthy. Just received it, so I haven't had a chance to read it in detail. But no, there's still no timeline. There's still no timeline to when they'll have a plan. And we have these contaminants leaching, you know, to a public beach, at which safety hazard warnings have been issued for this foam. Nothing, no plans to even deal with that in the short term. Very, very frustrating. Very frustrating.
The organization that you co-founded, Need Our Water, what are you prioritizing right now, given where things stand?
Our number one priority is for the Air Force to stop the bleeding of these contaminants and contain it within the base, to stop it from going into the groundwater and the surface water, primarily the surface water, would be the Ossabaw River and Van Etten Lake, which come together and flow into Lake Huron. Everything that comes from that base ends up in Lake Huron, which is a source of drinking water for millions of people. So what we're saying is, you know, stop the bleeding, put a tourniquet on this, and then let's go from there.
Sarah, as you note in the film, the U.S. military is the largest single emitter of PFAS chemicals in the country, but it's far from the only one. And again, these chemicals are still not regulated. Can you catch us up on what stands in the way of that right now?
Well, that's a question that we explore in this film. What stands in the way of it? You know, we have known about these chemicals for a long time, and people who are in the scientific and government communities have known about it even longer. I mean, the public is starting to catch up to where the science has been for a while. And I don't think there's an end in sight to regulating PFAS. When you talk to people on Capitol Hill, it's not around the corner. And, you know, that was one of my first questions. Why not? It's clearly toxic. So what's standing in the way of regulating it? And that's a big tie-in to this story. There's a huge conflict of interest. The federal government is the largest polluter of this chemical that we know of in the United States. And it's also the regulator, or the entity that determines if there should be regulation. And when the science is as clear as it is, I think that that leads you right to the question of, well, why aren't they doing anything?
Sarah Ganim is the producer of No Defense. She is known for her work with CNN and also for stories breaking the Jerry Sandusky sex abuse case. We've also been talking with Tony Spaniola, a founding member of Need Our Water in Oscoda, Michigan, and an attorney. Both of you, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The film No Defense will premiere in Ann Arbor's Michigan Theater tonight. Coming up, two Detroiters discuss connecting with their African roots and rethinking their place in the world. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The government of Ghana spent 2019 inviting African Americans to visit. Last year was the 400th anniversary of the arrival of enslaved Africans in North America. Here's a taste of the tourism campaign, which was officially branded the Year of Return.
I'm a human being in Africa, but a black man in America. African in England. Don't forget where you are from. Ghana down to Suriname. Taking from my motherland. Don't forget your mother tongue. Please don't shoot me, we are one.
For some people with Ghanaian ties, the pilgrimage was a chance to visit with family. For a much broader slice, it was a chance to reconsider one's place in the world. What would it be like to move through life as just another face in the crowd, not as a black American in majority white spaces? It was a mix of both for Maurice Cheatham, who's now helping others make the journey. Maurice, you're originally from Detroit. What first brought you to Ghana?
You know, my experience at Ghana was like surreal. I'm half Ghanaian. My father was born and raised in Ghana, came to the United States and had me and raised me. He retired back to Ghana early 90s, maybe 1995. He consistently asked me to come visit him. I never came and visited. Ghana just wasn't a cool place to go. And about 5 years ago, my father passed. I got a call that I was going to have to come bury my father. And that's what brought me to Ghana my first time.
I mean, obviously, that had to have been a hugely emotionally loaded trip. But to the extent that you were able to process things beyond, you know, beyond your father's death, what were your impressions?
Well, first of all, I was overwhelmed. Stepping off into the airport, I had seen more people of ever in African descent in my entire life. But one of the things that surprised me was there were so many people that looked like people that I knew, I went to college with. You know, tall, dark, short, fat, you know, light-complected, dark-complected. In addition to, I had seen more development than what I thought I would see. There were buildings everywhere. There were cranes everywhere building things. There were skyscrapers and things of that nature. And so for me, that was a little bit surreal.
How would you describe what the feel of being there was like? As we mentioned, we're actually talking to you in Ghana now, which is where you decided to live. What was it that first put into your head that maybe this was the kind of place you wanted to stay?
For me, like I said, in between that five-year period, because I was dealing with estate matters with my father, I came back like almost like maybe like 10 to 15 times.
Oh, wow.
Just to handle matters with my father, dealing with family issues. But each time I came back, I felt free. It was just like reaching out. You just see the potential, the opportunity of a place that is growing right in front of your eyes. And from a security standpoint, I lived all around Detroit. I lived in the suburbs. It was to the point where I could walk at night. I could feel free. The interaction with the police was just free. People here are so friendly. If you drop something on the ground, they'll pick it up. It just wasn't that natural fear that we deal with our interaction with people at home.
Also with us today is Imani Mixon. She's a journalist and writer who's based in Detroit, who traveled recently to Ghana. Imani, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you spent 3 weeks there over the holidays, right?
Yes, I was there from December 15th to January 5th, and it was my first time to Africa and definitely my first time in Ghana.
Were you just, I mean, did you just consider this as a vacation?
I think similarly, a little bit to what Maurice is saying, it was a lot of things going on at once. So there was a year of return for a lot of Black people anywhere in the diaspora. That was part of the reason, and I think that also made it easier as far as information goes to figure out, you know, how to get shots, how to get there, where to stay. And also a very central portion of my trip is the fact that my boyfriend is Ghanaian. And so that was a shortcut. I didn't have to Google too much.
What was the experience like for you?
It was beautiful. I think growing up in Detroit, I'm obviously used to all Black spaces and Black pride, I guess is how you can phrase it. But there was something really beautiful to be able to look around and see every level of Blackness, right? Like there was no stop. Like maybe in Detroit, you are out somewhere, you know, you're with your people and it's all Black. But if you keep going up the ladder, you'll find someone who's not. And I think Ghana has a really tall ladder. So it was just amazing to see people in power, people just living their lives, people like making their lives. And yeah, it's just Black for miles and miles and miles. And I think my main thing is like, if I'm there and there were some kind of weird interaction, which I didn't have, it wasn't racism. Like, that's not what I was dealing with. Mm. So it felt really empowering to be there and very inviting as well.
Maurice, you ultimately made the decision to uproot your life and go to Ghana to help other people make this journey. And you now run the business African Roots Travel. What inspired you to do that?
As I started coming and sharing my journey, you know, me coming to Ghana for the first time and putting it on Facebook and sharing it throughout my professional and social network, people start to reach out and ask questions that they always wanted to ask about Africa. And they were very succinct questions. And, you know, I don't mean to offend anybody. Hey, you know, are they eating dogs over there? Is Al-Qaeda over there? You know, will I walk down the street and will I get shot? You know, is there poverty? And these were things that, like I said, these are African-Americans asking these questions. And they had nobody to reach out to that they knew who had went to Africa, who had traveled to Africa, really had been to Ghana from an intimate standpoint. So I started sharing that and started sharing certain posts and started sharing videos. And it started to get a little bit, it started to get bigger and bigger. And people really wanted to build a relationship even before the year of return with Africa. And they just needed somebody to connect with.
What are some of the misconceptions that people may have about Ghana?
For some reason, there is the impression is that there's no money in Ghana, that Ghana is a poor country. I would like to state that there's no formal credit system in Ghana. Everything is paid for cash. When a lot of people come here, they come here with preconceived notions that people don't have money here. Corruption plays a big part in Ghana. And, you know, Nigeria comes to Ghana and spends their money. And just in 2016, Nigeria had $16 billion of wealth stolen. That comes to Ghana. So just to say that is understand there's major money floating around here. If you start to really look around at the houses and the cars that are driven, all those cars are paid for cash. So just come with an open mind and come just really ready to understand it on all levels.
I think I just had one thing to add about sort of the preconceived notions that we have. I think Maurice kind of touched on it, but I think a part of being able to respect a country that you are visiting is also being able to just like change your expectations. Like things just look different, sound different, smell different, taste different. But in the same way that you would go to Paris and accept that as normal, like that same open-mindedness needs to also be granted to countries that, you know, we kind of owe ourselves to. So even though, you know, there's this new renewed interest in, you know, returning to Africa and like visiting all these countries, there are some, you know, expectations that it'll feel just like home and look just like home, and that's just not how it is. So I think for me, it took being able to just settle, pack your patience. Somebody gave me that tip before we left, and just like be open to experiencing whatever is there for you to experience, and count that as your trip, and don't think about it as like an Instagram opportunity.
Tell me a little bit more about what the year of return has meant. It's obvious that the government of Ghana has awakened to this idea that Americans, you know, that Americans want to come, and that Americans may have questions about their histories and their past. Was there anything beyond just the branding of the year as the year of return? And Imani, I don't know if there was anything that you had access to before going about what the year of return was going to mean. What does it mean that they're, when we say they're encouraging folks to take the trip?
I think it means many things, obviously on a very tangible level with discounted citizenship and discounts on land. It's definitely something that I was privy to because of my connection to Ghana through my boyfriend, who's, I just need to call him his name, Brendan Asante. So he does a lot of, he's an Afrobeats artist here in the city, and he also does a lot of bridging the gap between the African community and like the Black Detroit community. So I definitely knew about it. And I think, you know, every year there's a different country that is like the place to go for breaks. And I think for some people, that's how Ghana appeared. But for other people, there definitely was a deeper meaning and almost a calling to be able to go back to your potentially ancestral homeland.
Maurice, what did the year of return mean to you as someone who was becoming a resident?
For me to look around and see, as Imani just said, it was past the point of people just coming for a novelty. People were coming for a real connection because they were invited home. And this is something they had long yearned to have. Was someone to say, hey, we want you to come here. We want you to be a part of this. I mean, it really was special for people who had no idea about Africa, no idea of wanting to come and connect and come and connect, most importantly, with the people. There are a bunch of parties, there are a bunch of world-class events, but to connect with the people is what it really meant. And I think it's something special that's going to continue.
When people hear that you, as an American, have moved to Ghana, what is their reaction?
As far as concerning Ghanaians?
Yeah.
You know, and I would probably take it before the year of return. Initially, when I came to bury my father, the whole movement from parts of my family was that I wasn't going to come back, that I was going to leave. But now that I've been here for 3 years, still don't know the language, got a tree. It's an interaction. They feel proud to know that you're really here, that you're really trying to interact with the people. So sometimes people come here and they go visit historic sites, which we have to. But if you don't interact with the people, you don't have a real experience to understand what's going on now in the communities. And I think that once we do that, that you can walk around in any neighborhood here and, as I might say, interact with anyone. And it's just so much grace and pride because they want to talk to us.
Do you feel like people in Ghana, do you feel like they really can understand the otherness that many Black Americans feel within their own lives?
I do think there's a human element to all this, and I feel like it depends on the generation that we're talking about. For example, we traveled up to Kumasi, which is basically like from Detroit to Chicago, for the Christmas season for me to meet some more extended family. And, you know, they've been in those same places for years and years in the same way that my grandparents have been. So I think there is a rootedness in that way of living. And then I think if we're talking about maybe people in my generation who are, you know, grew up in Ghana, maybe went to school elsewhere, they also are dealing with the double consciousness. But I do think that there is space for just more commonalities. Like, I don't think it has to be so black and white. I think we're all in the gray area. And I think that a Ghanaian existing in a world that's still predominantly white and potentially racist is going to run into something too. So it didn't feel like there was necessarily a different fight that we were fighting or a fight that we were fighting at all, but we were just trying to all come together.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Imani Mixon, journalist and writer based in Detroit, and Maurice Cheatham, the founder and managing director of African Roots Travel and a former Detroiter. Imani, it sounds like both of you had a little different experience than people who go to Ghana as just straight up tourists. But Imani, I know that while you were there, you visited the Elmina Castle. Could you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
For sure. That was really powerful. And I think that if you have a chance to go, obviously go. It was about a 3-hour drive from where we were staying in Accra. And I got the sense that I was the only Black American in the tour group that I was in. Everybody else was either Ghanaian or like Ghanaian and living in Britain, like that kind of thing. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I think there were other groups that maybe had more, like if you came with a huge group, a travel group or something like that. But there obviously is a very different relationship to slavery within Black Americans, I think. So I was just very somber, and it was a very heavy place. And I'm a very intuitive person, I would say. So you could just feel that horrible things happened in every single place that you went into. So it really was just beautiful. Like, I felt like I was bringing my whole family, my whole lineage, my whole ancestral line with me to this place that maybe we had been to before. So there was a responsibility for me to ask some tougher questions and listen a little harder. And like, there were just really no laughs or smiles during that whole time for me. But I do think that it was necessary. It's something that we're taught. And I think, you know, there is a sense, though, I saw something on Twitter where, you know, a lot of Black people don't learn about Black history without starting from slavery. And there's so much more than that. So it felt like a privilege to be able to go beyond, to, you know, get the lesson, but also be able to move past it.
In that way.
Yeah.
Maurice, how would you say, what have you observed during the year of return of Americans, you know, being ready to go and confront the history?
I think that, as Imani said, you see pictures, you see videos, you know, with YouTube, people showing things and their experiences. But when you walk through those doors, and specifically when you enter the actual dungeon, it grabs you. You can, and I'm not a spiritual person that way, but you can feel the spirit of your ancestors. When you're going in one part and they tell you that you are standing upon the DNA of dead bodies and skeletal remains and feces that's been caked up on this floor. And it just grabs you. You're sad. You want to connect. You feel a certain sense of joy when you walk through the door of no return. It really is a homecoming. It's a homecoming. And you have to go to both Elmina and Cape Coast. Let me be clear, because they have two distinct different histories. And you can see the difference with the colonizers and what the triple passage was all about and who was really included and held everyone accountable. So we need to know this history. This is ours. We own it.
I'm about to ask something that may be kind of hard to answer, because I know that you don't wrap up a whole country in just a top what to see list, and that this trip means a lot more than just vacation for a lot of people. But I did wonder if someone asked you maybe two or three things that they should see if they're going, what would you tell them?
I'm gonna flip the list. I'm gonna start off and say, and I don't know if mine did this, but I'm gonna start off and say that they need to see the new Ghana as well. And what is the new Ghana? The new Ghana is not advertised. You have to be in the know. It's lounges, it's parties, it's art shows, it's fashion shows, it's networking. It's a very hip crowd. So I tell them is, even after their tours, make sure they connect at night and try to find out what some of these events, because they don't connect with the people right now. In the next 10 years, you will not know Ghana. The Chinese are here. The Indians are here. Everybody's investing in Ghana. It is very expensive to stay here. So I want to make sure they connect with not just the past, but the present.
Maurice Cheatham is the founder and managing director of African Roots Travel in Ghana. He talked to us via Skype. And we've also been speaking with Imani Mixon, a journalist and writer based in Detroit. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Baby, let's cruise away from here.
Before we go today, we want to wish a very happy 80th birthday to Motown legend Smokey Robinson. I cannot believe this genius man is 80 years old.
And if you want it, you got it forever. This is not a one-night stand, baby.
He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. And in 2016, he was awarded the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for lifetime contributions to popular music. Have you ever wondered where the name Smokey came from?
Well, Smokey tells it that as a child, his Uncle Claude took him to a whole lot of cowboy and western movies. He loved these films so much that Uncle Claude gave him the cowboy nickname Smokey Joe, and the name stuck ever since. We love you, cowboy. Happy 80th, and thanks for lifting our hearts. That's our show for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow. Baby, too.